Hello and welcome to In Your Nature podcast. I'm Ricky Whelan.
And I'm Niall Hatch. You're very welcome to another episode. And just to kick things off by saying that In Your Nature is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly. And the series is supported by Laois, Offaly and Westmeath County Councils and the Heritage Council.
The subject of today's podcast is all about ponds. And I suppose we can't talk about ponds without talking about frogs and newts. And sort of the frogs have certainly done their business already. They're very early breeders. So it's sort of that's gone past. That spectacle has departed us for another year. But the birds are only getting sort of fired up now. But let's not get distracted on birds. Let's talk about ponds.
Yeah, I love ponds because they support so much biodiversity, including birds. You know, anyone who has a pond in their garden or in a park nearby will notice how good they are for so many different types of birds. But also the invertebrate life, the insects you see there, it's absolutely incredible. I could spend hours watching dragonflies and damselflies when they're starting to emerge now this time of year. You see them going around the ponds. They're absolutely incredible creatures. And one of the most fun things to do with children, when we have family groups at some of our nature reserves, like the East Coast Nature Reserve, in County Wicklow. I remember doing pond dipping there with kids, and just the most popular activity you could ever do. The stuff that lives in ponds here in Ireland is just remarkable.
No, it's great. It really is. And I mean, top of the pops within the ponds. Like, you're always excited. My ponds, I suppose, growing up were the ditches and the bog holes, really. You know, there wasn't a great culture, certainly in my neighbourhood, of having the garden pond, or there wasn't any sort of pristine ponds around. So it was all kind of, we had an old infill canal just down the back of the sort of houses as well, which was always, it always stayed wet. It was always great for frog spawn. But one thing we never seen back then was newts. That was a sort of species that was sort of new to me, really. It was almost, I suppose, in my teens or even later before I realized there was such a thing in Ireland. You know, it looked so kind of lizard-like and strange and a bit foreign. But we do have basically, we've one frog species, the common frog in Ireland, and we've one native newt species as well, the smooth newt. So they're charismatic little things.
Oh, they are. And especially when you see one of the males in all of his breeding finery, they look like dragons, like little miniature dragons. And sometimes you can see them, especially when they're moving between ponds, that they're out walking sometimes in paths and trails and in leaf litter. And they look quite bizarre. It's not something you expect to see. Again, they do look quite like a bit like a lizard that's kind of made of shiny rubber. That's kind of the way they look to me. They're really quite spectacular. But it's always a treat to see one because they are quite rare and they're very unpredictable. Sometimes they could be in a pond one year, you go back the next year and they're just not there. They just seem to vanish. They seem a lot more sporadic than frogs do. The newts are really fascinating because there are quite a few species all across Europe. Newts and salamanders are quite closely related to them as well, but they're quite different to frogs and toads, like our native of natterjack toad that we have, another very scarce species. But throughout most of Ireland, you're not going to see the natterjack, so it's just the common frog and the smooth newt that you might see. And they have many similar adaptations. I mean, they both start life as eggs that develop into tadpoles in the water. The way they lay the eggs is quite different. They look quite different. But they start like that, and then they develop. And it's only the very lucky few who actually go on to reach adulthood. The mortality rate among the youngsters of both the frogs and the newts is absolutely enormous because there's so many things out there eating them. They're food for a lot of fish. They're food for dragonfly larvae. Dragonfly larvae, by the way, for my money, one of the most impressive residents of a pond. They're just, they're small, so we can kind of appreciate them. If they were any bigger, if they were the size of a dog, they're the most terrifying predator on the planet. You know, we'd want to avoid them. So all these tadpoles, they have, you know, this terrain to range against and to cope with. So the few that do make it, I think it's always worth celebrating that we have any at all. They're great creatures.
No, absolutely. And we invited an expert in all things, I suppose, ponds and reptiles and amphibians in Dr. Rob Gandola, who is the scientific officer with the Herpetological Society of Ireland. And for people who are not familiar with that word, it's the study of reptiles and amphibians. So that's what a herpetologist is. And Rob will tell you a bit more about his background as we get into the interview. And I've really, really enjoyed doing it with him. And Rob is a colleague of a past guest, Collie Ennis, who the two of them really are excellent ambassadors and I suppose superheroes sort of driving home the message to create ponds and pond creation and conservation and all that. Because in this country, due to land reclamation, drainage of our bogs, in the, sort of the as we keep saying, the intensification of agriculture, ponds are disappearing at a sort of rate of knots, and anything we can do to sort of get new ponds in around the place or restore ponds and look after existing ponds is certainly a must. So over to Rob, I think. Put it in an Irish context. So what are our native herbophiles, and in terms of reptiles and amphibians, what have we got native here in Ireland?
So Ireland is very easy for everybody. It's great. We have one of everything that's native. We have one native lizard, we have one native frog, one native toad, and one native newt. And now we've got a couple of non-natives that have come on the scene fairly recently. But there are four main natives, and there's generally quite good or well-supported evidence that they're natives now as well. In terms of global diversity, Ireland would be quite poor. It wouldn't be as bad as somewhere like Antarctica or Iceland, you know, or some of the islands where they'd have no herps. But like being on the very edge of Europe, right off the continent, the fact that we were isolated quite early from the continent as well after the last ice age meant that even our neighbours in Britain would have far more diversity than we do. But, you know, so that's why a lot of people will come to me and say, how does an Irish person get involved in this? You know, and generally my answer is, well, I'm half Irish. My dad was from the north of Italy. So, you know, I'd be chasing snakes and stuff when I was small. When we go back and my dad would visit his family. And then, you know, I went to work abroad for a long time and I've worked on crocodilians and snakes and chameleons and frogs all over the planet. So, you know, that's how you get your experience. And then you come back and you apply what you've learned and put it in an Irish context. You know, because the challenges facing Irish herps, even though we only have four native species, are no different to the challenges facing reptiles and amphibians anywhere else on the planet at the moment. You know, we're not a bubble. The fact that we are seen as a developed nation doesn't exclude us from the challenges of conservation. No matter what your flavour of wildlife is, you know, your preferred taxonomic group. So
I would say anyone that's qualified to sort of get involved with Nile crocodiles is certainly more than qualified to get involved with a few viviparous lizards on the bogs in sort of Ireland. So it's an interesting link, but absolutely the tools and the skills you've learned all over the world and in UCD and across your fieldwork here, I mean, it's so important. And as you say, unfortunately, you might sort of rattle off. I'm sure you could be probably still listing it in a half hour's time, but you might sort of spell out some of the sort of risks or threats facing reptiles and amphibians in Ireland.
Yeah, so the one unifying threat that affects them all really is what's affecting, you know, almost every other element of the Irish wildlife. And that's, you know, habitat loss, land use change, habitat degradation, whatever name you want to give it, it's all the same thing. It means less habitat, less amounts of space. Like we're on an island, you know, as my uncle who lives in Connemara likes to say, you know, it's the same from the farmers over there. God won't make more land. And, you know, it is an island and that's like inherently true. So the loss of good quality habitat, and that's what it is. Like animals can hang on, like our herps are fairly resilient. Like a lot of our wildlife is, it's quite resilient to change, you know, and they can hang on in marginal habitats, but that's not indefinite. You know, they will eventually, you know, all it takes then is a minute stressor and they'll be gone. So we need to nip this in the bud, you know, and try and, you know, get the wins where they're possible in the face of every other challenge that's been thrown at society at the moment. You know, and a lot of this is just kind of keeping good habitats in good condition and trying to encourage people to, because creating good habitat, actually, it's not difficult, but you know, there are challenges to it. We're very lucky insofar as we don't have a lot of the problems associated with amphibian disease that Great Britain and the rest of continental Europe and the world has. So as far as we're aware, and the HSI did the original screening 10 years ago now this year, like it's gone in 10 years fast. We don't have any of the really big pathogenic fungi that are destroying amphibian populations worldwide. There's neither of the chytrid fungi are here. And we don't appear to have the ranavirus, which will also kill newts as well. Now, whether they're here and they're at really low levels of prevalence is like everybody you speak to are saying that's probably the case. There's, like, why would Ireland escape when nowhere else has? But there's been no update to the screening. You know, it's very difficult for us to convince the powers that be and the funders that that screening is a worthwhile exercise doing, because it's proactive. And generally, Ireland as a country, when it comes to conservation, is always reactive rather than proactive. You know, but we do need to start looking at these things, like the climate is changing. Warm, shallow water is what a lot of these diseases need to thrive in. And that's what our amphibians like to breed in. The world is changing, and I think we need to change with it as well. We need to be ahead of the game instead of, you know, trying to catch up when the horse is already bolted. We need to kind of be ahead of the curve.
Absolutely. And I mean, you talked about sort of, you know, the vulnerability of island populations, and when there's, I suppose, habitats loss and fragmentation, those populations get very isolated and they're more vulnerable. And I mean, we see that kind of with the toads in Ireland and the natterjacks, you know, because any one thing could sort of wipe them out. It could be a local disease, a pathogen, like you've just mentioned. It could be a wildfire. Anything like that could wipe out a whole local population, and you're missing almost, I don't know, how much of the natterjack population is down in Kerry alone? I mean, it's...
Yeah, sure, it's all of it. Sure, they're all in Kerry, yeah. So, you know, like there's the insurance population that's in Wexford, but that's it's not even on the same kind of scale as what you'd still find in Kerry. You know, and their dune race of natterjacks, they're not like in the UK where you'll have your dune races and you'll have your heathland breeding natterjacks. They're very susceptible to things like, you know, major storm event. Like, and they have somewhat tolerance of saline conditions. But if dunes get wiped out with a major storm or with sea level rise, or, you know, like dune systems disappear after major storm events, as we know from elsewhere along the West Coast, you know, beaches come and go. Like one year you have, what was it, the one up in Mayo, it's one of the best beaches in the world. Yeah, and then it disappears, you know, and then it comes back 10 years later or whatever. So these systems are like, they're very fragile and are very prone to be destroyed or at least undergo serious disturbances, you know, and like the sea and the Atlantic don't tend to be, like, they're harsh mistresses, you know. So I think we just need to be careful.
The other thing is, maybe less tangible thing, is even the genetic pool becoming more shallow over time in these isolated populations as well, and that weakens the species further. So it's really, really complex at the end of the day, and we like to keep this podcast as positive as we can. So I mean, let's talk a bit about maybe the habitats now and what we can do and stuff. So tell me, I mean, the herp sock are obviously big, they're your pond pushers is what I call it, which is great. And I'm a big fan of pond creation, and we can learn a lot from what you guys do and everything else. So tell me why a pond is such premium habitat for the likes of our frogs and our newts.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you that it needs to be positive. And that's what I was going to allude to. The most beneficial thing you can do, and it's what we've been saying like since the HSI came back into existence in 2009, was that the best thing you can do for nature, and generally we'd be pushing it from a reptile and amphibian perspective, is build a pond. But obviously it's going to benefit everything above and below them in the food web, you know, because you're creating new habitat. You're not, and like you can try and say it's species specific, but Irish species, they're so generalist in their habitats that it's going to benefit everything. Ponds are incredible because building block of life, if there's no water, there's no life. That's the truth of, that's the honest truth of it, you know, and like it's irrefutable. It encourages bugs, you have your aquatic plants, you know, and this is just wildlife ponds. Some of the recent science is now suggesting that, like, between the sediment and the vegetation, ponds can sequester anywhere between kind of 20 to 200 times more carbon than an adjacent grassland or woodland of a similar size, you know, of similar surface area. Like, that's incredible. When everybody's talking about carbon budgets and you're kind of turning away 90% of Joe Public because they're sick of hearing carbon sequestration and carbon budgets and all of this amount of carbon being released, you know, the way you win people back is say, listen, this is going to do what all the lads on the telly are buying and selling credits for, and they're telling you is going to, like, it's key to saving the world. But what you're going to get in exchange is you're going to get a lovely wetland feature that you can use for education, for sitting there and just being super chill and enjoying your local wildlife population. You know, if you've got a platform or if it's a public park and the local authority are going to fund it, tell them to lash in a platform that the kids can do pond dipping on it to look at the incredible wildlife that will colonize, and then use it for yoga and other stuff that make people feel good about themselves and feel good about the habitat. And this is what I say to, like, and it's an engineering principle. It's actually a new engineering principle that's actually being pushed for new development with, you'll hear about SUDs, you know, like sustainable urban drainage. And it always has to meet the three criteria, right? So when it's written by engineers, right, so the three criteria would be flipped for wildlife people like you and I. It has to be engineering, and it has to be functional, right? So it has to do the job. So if your pond is there to make sure this new housing estate doesn't flood, fantastic, right? So it's doing its job. It's hanging on to the water and maybe slowly releasing it to the nearby river system or the surface water drainage system or whatever over time. That's brilliant. Number two then is it has to have inherently biodiversity value, right? But just putting a wetland feature, even a temporary wetland feature, which a lot of the SUDs would be, into the landscape where there wasn't one before, or there was one like a pond maybe of poor quality, now increases that, the quality of the habitat for the local wildlife populations, which usually you can tell very quickly if they're going to move back in and start to use it. Like, so say it was a very shaded, overgrown pond that was looked on as a dumping site because it was shaded and overgrown and ugly. Now you've got a functioning pond that's nice to look at, and the wildlife now have little shallow warm areas because the sun's able to get on it again. You've got dragonflies coming in. So now it's a far better quality pond. And then the third facet then leads directly into that is it's of amenity value now, because everybody wants to see the wildlife. They want to know that the house they've just spent a fortune on paying is going to be safe from flooding. And now they have somewhere that they can go and chill out and just enjoy it because it's there. You know, so that's a really good principle. And that's kind of the way we try and get people on our side. It's not just about build ponds for wildlife because that's great. That's that's what we want. But you have to convince people whose agenda may not be fully driven by adversity or by wildlife at all. You have to kind of win them over with all the co-benefits of putting wetlands back into their local environment, you know?
Definitely. And in a lot of things, habitat-wise, like size does matter, and there's no getting away from that. So, like, it's, you know, the bigger the better. If you've got a farm in a wet corner, it's a natural good place to sort of get the excavator in and dig a pond. But equally, like our friend and colleague, Collie Ennis, is a great man for the micro pond. And I mean, basin size, sink size, bathtub size thing sank in the ground. I mean, it's going to, first you're going to get the little sort of mosquito larvae in there. Then you're going to get the bigger sort of aquatic predatory beetles. Then you're going to start, you know, you're going to get some plant life, and then it's going to, you know, really get dynamic. And I suppose the big take home message, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the difference between a wildlife pond and a big hole in the ground with water in it is that there's usually no fish in there, because fish tend to hoover up everything from plants to eggs to insects to other fish to adult insects, you know, emerging insects and all that sort of stuff. So if you really want, and of course amphibians and newts and frogs, but if you want sort of a diversity of life, it's probably better off definitely not sticking goldfish in there, and probably not throwing in a jar of minnows or sticklebacks either, I suppose. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right, bang on. But it's not that all fish are an issue. Like you will see smaller fish like sticklebacks in with newts and frogs in a huge number of ponds. It's the bigger kind of fish and the non-native ones like the carps, the goldfish and all of those and the koi are a big issue, although people see value in large koi now, so they'll try and get them back out if they see them in ponds. But what they tend to do is they'll eat the eggs, you know, and even sticklebacks will wear down a population, particularly of newts over time, you know. So ideally they will be fish free, but that's not always possible, you know, because, like, as we see now, stickleback eggs will survive the digestive tract of herons, you know, so they can be moved from pond to pond, you know, indirectly. So, like, there's been a, like, let's be realist, if you're going to dig a garden pond, that's fine. And if it's in your garden and you look at it every day, you can manage it for fish. If it's going to be a larger pond that's going to be put in by the local authority or by, you know, by farmers who may be using it for other issues, like they might put in an integrated constructed wetland, you know, to deal with runoff from the yard and treat it in a natural way. So it's a terraced system, so you'll have a top, a middle, and a bottom. In some cases, that bottom pond, the water in there will be probably the best quality water around, you know, depending on what's going on agriculturally in the other fields. So, like, the key is clean water. It's not even fish free. It's clean water is where you get your maximum benefits. And you can do all the fun things about how you'd go and assess your local pond or your own pond, about how clean the water is in it, you know. So you go looking for things like, you know, dragonfly nymphs and damselfly nymphs when you're doing a bit of pond dipping, because they only really will breed in generally quite good, clean quality water. You know, so they're a really good indicator. Amphibians tend to be far more lax when it comes to, you know, water qualities. That's why they get 0 points. Nearly all of the scoring systems are based on invertebrates, because they're far more sensitive to changes in water quality. You know, but like, I like to think of, like, you could create some sort of traffic light system, you know, where you'd have a green, a red, and an amber based on, you know, the diversity in it, and you still, and maybe there's some points to have, like, frogs in it because they are an EU protected species as well as a national. Newts as well, because they're the only Uridel on the island. You know, they're the only salamander, member of the salamander family on the island, and they are native. So you might get an extra couple of points for that. But it's the key ones are the invertebrates. So the likes of like your mayflies and your dragonfly nymphs in particular, and your damselfly nymphs, you know, and some of the plants as well. Like, so chara, this cool green algae that people get excited about. You tend to find it in very heavy clay areas and areas where there's like mineral deposits. That only tends to like to live in very clean water. And you'll find it in ridiculous places like tire tracks from heavy machinery, where rainwater has filled up, but because it's on a clay substrate, the algae has gone, woohoo, this is clean because it's rainwater. And there's no inputs because it's only filled because of the rain. So there's no source of pollution really. And it starts to grow in ridiculous places like small puddles. But when you see that growing in like large ponds, it's a really good indicator that the water is actually of quite good quality. You know, so you can do the cool stuff by like getting stuck in and get your hands in there and touching stuff and seeing stuff and all of that, you know. So that's what we promote when it comes to ponds. You know, don't just build it for the wildlife, build it so that you can enjoy it as well.
We've got two good local examples here in Laois. There's a SUDS project, I guess. It's a ribbon of lakes in the largest housing estate in Port Laois called Kilminchie. And it's, I think it's probably three lakes. So there's the upper lake, and then there's the middle one, and then there's the lower one. And the top basically receives this sort of street water. It's like oily, it's murky, it's full of like, it's really sort of, it's just ill looking, and there's nothing up there. There's no insects, there's no birds in the reeds. Then the middle lake, you start seeing a few birds around the place and a few bits and pieces. And then by the time the water is filtered by all the plants and the stuff down the bottom lake, it's like thriving with life. So it really, really works well, that system. And it's a really nice place to visit, even though it's like so heavily urbanized and under a lot of pressures. But like that ribbon of lakes, that system sort of cleaning itself as it goes, it's really, really works well. And then there's this other one. It's a full-on water treatment plant. It's one of those integrated systems. It's a reed bed. And there's like 5 reed beds. And the first one basically receives the raw sewage straight from the village in Clunnaslee. And then the next one, sort of the reed bed filters it through. So the kind of smell's gone out of it. The heavy sort of stuff is gone then, and it's just liquid. Then by the third pond, you're starting to see like loads of like sedge wobblers in the reed beds. You're starting to see amphibians. You're starting to see frogs and stuff. And then by the fifth, it's like, you know, it's like the Amazon rainforest. It's like just alive. And it's a really exciting place. It's actually just full of bird life. And that to me indicates that it's full of insects, which indicates to me that it's just really, really healthy. So by the time you get to the fifth pool. So they do work. And it's exciting that local authorities are doing these things and going down that road and being sort of steered that way by the likes of you guys. So it's good to see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was wondering if you're going to mention Clunnaslee, because I was invited there by Irish Water to Oirisca Éireann now to have a look at it, you know, with a group of other people there last autumn. And it's an incredible spot. And I know there's plans now to open it up to the local community. You know, there was some proper thought put into it. Like, so they future-proofed it because they're using, I think it's 9 of the 15 acres that they have there for the site. So they can essentially double the capacity into the future. If Clunnaslee village doubles in size, they can handle it. The spinner that takes all of like the toilet paper and, you know, anything else that gets flushed is all operated by gravity and by force of the water coming in. So if there's a break in the power grid, it doesn't affect the functioning of the constructed wetland. It's absolutely incredible. I was really excited about it, and everybody else that was there were kind of, you know, they were either operational managers for Ishgairn, or they were, you know, they were there for other reasons. So, but I was the big wildlife nerd there, telling them like how great this was. They're saying there's buzzards actually nesting over it, because obviously they've got those lovely mature trees around the edges on the perimeter fence. So, and this is what you kind of have to show people about how we actually can engineer ourselves into a much better situation now, while also, you know, providing the service of doing something like cleaning grey water. This is exactly what would be classed as a nature-based solution, right? You're doing something that's, yeah, it's engineered, but you're letting nature clean the water. It's all reed beds, it's iris, it's willows, you know, they're all taking the nutrient burden out of the water. So by the time the water goes back in to either the groundwater, it goes into the local stream, it's now, I wouldn't recommend you drink it, but it's in far better condition than it was when it came in, you know, and probably better condition than when it went into the house, you know, in the first place, before it left their attic or their tank. But see, these are brilliant. And again, like, this is all part of having your cake and eating it. You can have very engineered habitats and they'll be good for wildlife. And this is where we have to take our wins, you know, more promotion of this nature-based solution. Get your suds in, get your water treat, your natural water treatment in. And again, tie it into other stuff like district heating. At some of these grey water treatment plants, like I know in Serbia and stuff now, they use the excess heat that's generated from cleaning the drinking water. They pump it back into the local village. So these lads have free central heating. That's the future. If we're serious about keeping our habitats and maintaining them or making them better, and while also, you know, making the quality of life better for Irish people in general, we have to start being smart and doing these things, you know, doing them properly. And we wouldn't have to be the guinea pig. It's already proven that these things work for wildlife and for people as well.
It's great, because, you know, only recently I'm sort of new on the scene in the local authority world, and it's an eye-opener to me how it works. And, you know, the reach of a local authority and the opportunities that are there in all the departments, whether it's planning or housing or water or roads or whatever, like, there's all these, like, I just, like, you know, you can give the engineers a nudge and say, lads, plant that there on the edge of the road, or what are you doing there with suds and all that sort of stuff. But it's so beneficial now to have good examples like that to show them, that you're not kind of going, oh, in America they do this, because they're like, right, yeah, come on, like, I'm busy. But if you can literally throw a couple of lads in a car and bring them over to Clonisley, you know, and show them what's been done, or anywhere else. We have a lovely project in Tullamore at the minute called Tullamore Wetland, and it's sort of like just took a big gouge out of the side of the river to try slow the flow a bit and take out some of the sediments. And it's probably not going to be sort of good for amphibians or anything, but it'll certainly be good for insects and, you know, fish and everything else, so and birds for sure. So that's really exciting. So this stuff is happening, which is great. And Rob, before, sort of lastly, if you could wrap up with a bit of a crash course in pond creation for people who, you know, it does the do's and don'ts, the principles of it. I mean, let's not even go into size. Just, I mean, let's talk how you do it, when you do it, you know, about sort of getting water.
Absolutely. So the big thing is, right, you know, everybody always tries to find a fancy acronym, you know, so that you can do step by step in your head. We haven't found one for ponds yet. It'd be far too long, or it'd sound absolutely ridiculous, where people would just refuse to use it. The first thing I always tell people to do is it's all about plan and design. Look at your garden, decide what size you can realistically have or what you're willing to manage. Then you do your basic checks. Make sure you've asked you know where your piping and your electricity work and everything is, if it's under your garden, before you start throwing a pickaxe or a digger into the lawn. The last thing you want to do is go through your grey water pipe. That's just, you don't want that at all. No, and then you do something like, you know, and everybody should know this anyway from when they're in the house. Look at where the sun is in your garden at different times of the day. And ideally throughout the spring and summer. Winter not so much, is not that important, but like the spring and the summer is very important. You want about 8 hours of light on your pond. Now, it doesn't have to be direct sunlight, but you want about 8 hours of light in your pond. A little bit of shade doesn't really make a difference. So once you've figured out where a good spot is, but you don't want it in full shade unless you want, like, so the thing about shaded ponds is, right, they're not bad. Shaded ponds tend to be very low in diversity, in biodiversity, and they tend to cater for very specialist species or very generalist species. And that's why, like, you'll either end up with a load of aquatic lice, so like the acellus, which is the aquatic version of wood lice, or else, and maybe one or two other specialists like alderflies and things like that, but you'd have to have the associated trees and kind of iris banks and stuff as well for the alderflies. So they tend to be quite low productivity, but you'll have very clean water, which will look nice, but they mightn't be very great, if, especially if you want it for wildlife. So try not to put it in the shade if you can. So you've chosen your location, you're sure there's no pipes under it, you know you're going to get your sun on it, then you have to start looking at liner. If you're in a new build housing estate, there's a very good chance you've 10 centimetres of topsoil and then you're down into building rubble. So you're not going to be able to use a liner of any sort. So now you're looking at, you have to look at like a pre-mould pond. So they're the big plastic ones that you can buy in garden centres and pet shops and stuff. They may be your only alternative, unless you're handy with DIY or with a bit of stone masonry and you're going to build a frame and then sit a liner inside it. You know, but that's possible. The only real thing then you need to do then is just make sure that there's a gentle ramp slope up to the pond, and then that's met usually on the other side by a gentle sloping ramp or rockery or whatever that goes down into the water. You know, there can't be, harsh angles aren't good for wildlife, particularly for things like hedgehogs, which apparently love to swim but are terrible at climbing. So if they can fall in and they don't have a very shallow ramp to walk their way out, they're just going to drown, and nobody wants to drown a hedgehog in their pond. If you're on the side where, okay, you've got a good amount of subsoil, you look down, you'll need to get under your topsoil anyway, so you can dig that off. And the way you know you've got rid of your topsoil is that's usually a dark kind of blacky brown colour. As soon as you get to the subsoil, it'll be a far paler, kind of a brownie or a grey. And this is very nutrient poor. So your topsoil you can shove somewhere else, throw it into a flower bed, use it somewhere else later on, depending on how artistic you're going to be around the design when your pond is finished. And then you can dig down into the subsoil. If you've got a lot of clay, you might need a liner. Now, when I'm saying clay, you want to have a high percentage, probably about 35% plus clay. And the way you'd factor this in is you go back to primary school, you dig up a handful of it, and you'd add water to it, and then you'd roll it around and see if you can make, almost like mala, see if you can make like a string snake out of it. And if it starts to crumble away, there's too many rocks or there's too much sand in it, so you're going to need a liner. And then if it's full of rock and sand, like straight away, then you're going to need a liner anyway. Generally, I'd recommend that if you want to be 100% secure in holding the water all year, just use a liner. So then it comes down to like that there's like loads of types of liner. So you can use bentonite, which is a natural clay liner that you can buy in pellet form, you can buy it in powder form. You essentially become almost like a pond plaster at that stage. You got to work it in, you got to wet it, you got to leave it for 72 hours to absorb the water, and you spread it around. You need quite a lot of it. So for bentonite and things, you're looking at like a 25 kilo sack for like a square meter. So you need a good kind of 5 to 10 centimeters of it. Just to ensure that it's going to hold your water, that the depth is big enough and it's not going to be cracked or ruptured by plant roots or from either within the pond or from trees nearby or anything else. Then you go into your plastic liners. You know, there's EPDM, which is the rubber one now. It's made from recycled Formula One tires. So you've got Michael Schumacher's tires now going to build, you know, into people's wildlife ponds. And I know people are very conscious about not wanting to put more rubber or plastic into their into the environment. But in most of these cases for pond liners, you know, it's the second, third, even fourth life of the material, you know, by the time it gets to just being good enough to be rolled out into a big rubber sheet. And then it comes down to your budget. If you're smart and you use, so there's stuff called underlay or pond fleece, you want about 200 to 500 grams per square meter when you're buying it, right? It costs about €4 per square meter. And I know people will not use it, and they'll use like old carpet and carpet tiles or builder sand and stuff. And that's wonderful. But what the pond fleece does is that it's essentially puncture proof. It's almost like Kevlar. So it means ponds, trees on the outside can't grow through it. Like sharp rocks or anything that might end up under your liner will be unable to puncture, even though your rubber or your PVC liner is going to be quite tear resistant anyway. So this is an extra layer. So you've got your underlay on the bottom, which I recommend if you're going to use carpet tiles, whatever, just some sort of protective layer. Then you've got your rubber or your plastic, and then you're into the top of it. And everybody recommends that, like, they're looking at ponds and everybody looks into it, and you see, you know, it's the plastic PVC or it's the plastic rubber. If you're going to get artistic, and I like the idea of people, you know, kind of letting their artistic flair, you know, or their engineering flair explode and they're building the garden pond, and you're going to put like nice pieces of granite, you know, or nice big bits of it might be a tree stump from the garden that looks incredibly gnarly and would look amazing, you know, hanging over a pond or based in the pond, or it's been weathered so there's nothing leaching out of it anymore. There's no point in spending good money on a liner and underlay and then sit this big heavy thing right on the top of it and then puncture it again. So my recommender is to make your liner sandwich. So buy a second layer of liner and sit it over the top of your PVC or your rubber liner. So you've got your sandwich, you've got your levels of underlay on the outside and the inside, and then you've got your liner in the middle. Most liners are guaranteed for 25 years. If you make the liner sambo with the two underlays, it's going to last 50 years, maybe 100 years, because physically there's no way of anything getting near it. You know, there's no UV rays getting near it. It's only if somebody actually digs it up and exposes it, you know, is where it's going to be. So I do that just to stop yourself from, you know, spending good money and then having a disaster by dropping a rock on it because you've taken your eye off the game, you know, because you're tired now and the end is in sight. So why do that? You can also buy it in black. So pond underlay can be bought in black. It's slightly more expensive to have it in black, but if you like the black color rather than a white color, you can get it in black as well, because I know people can be very fussy, and so they should be. And then that's really it. The rest of it then is down to you. Like, we'd recommend if you've got cobbles or gravel and you want to put like a nice shallow, like the ramping area for the hedgehog or that the birds will use for a bird bath, use some nice cobbles and some gravel. What they also do is when they're under the water, they increase the surface area for beneficial bacteria and microplants and everything, and like microbugs. You've got all these little microhabitats now, microclimates, micro areas for growing. So that's really good. It tends to keep your water clarity very nice as well. And because you have all this beneficial bacteria in there taking nutrients out of the water for their own needs. And then we always recommend you throw some dead wood like along the edges or over it, because it's good for emerging bugs. So if you've got pond mayflies, they'll climb up and hatch out, and dragonflies will do the same. Or if you've got some birds, you know, they'll sit on top of anything that's overlooking it. If you're looking, if they live by a stream, you could have a kingfisher in your garden, you know, because they like to perch, you know, yourself. You know, and really then it's down to you. What we don't recommend then is people go bananas and start attaching filters and things to it. As soon as you attach a pump, or even a solar pump or an aerator, and you put it in a wildlife pond, all of these machines, even the low voltage solar ones, is they all have an impeller which will suck all your microbugs in your water into the impeller, and they'll just chop it up into fish food. All you're doing is adding nutrients from dead animals into your water. So we don't recommend it unless you can put it in a place that's isolated and there's no way of anything but the water from the pond going in through that impeller, and doing that is quite a difficult task, or else you need an awful lot of space so that you isolate the pond, you know, in terms of like you're using mesh netting or aqua blocks or things like that so that the water can flow out of the pond into the pump and then be pumped up into a waterfall, you know, and it's just going to increase your spend, like probably double your spend, if not more. And we don't recommend you do it. You don't need it. Wildlife doesn't really like much of a flow underwater anyway. No, and that's kind of it. If you're going to plant it up, use native plants. It's very difficult to be 100% sure that the plants that you've sourced are of native stock. But if you can get it from native stock, I recommend that you do. Be very, very cautious when it comes to like the water milfoils. They all look the same. And one of them is particularly nasty. It's on the EU list of invasive species called parrot's feather. It's almost identical to the native milfoil, except the fact that it will grow out of the water and it will completely take over. And all your hard work will be undone because you'll have to drain the whole pond just to kill it. Or you'll have to smother your pond to stop sunlight getting at it to kill it. Very same as Lagerosiphon does in the lochs along the Shannon. You know, they're nasty, nasty plants. You don't want them in there to take over. So be very wise. And just be a bit cautious about what plants, if you're going to plant up your ponds, to use. Only use natives. Be careful with things like yellow flag, the iris. It's beautiful, but it does tend to take over. The same with bulrush. The same with, the australis, the phragmides as well. They will dominate small ponds very, very quickly. And you'll find you'll spend more time managing the pond than actually enjoying it. So, just be cautious. There is a list. I know the Ontarska Legacy for Life team will have a list of native aquatic plants up on their website. So you can go there for advice. And we're going to redo, the HSI is redoing our website soon. Or just email us and we'll send you the list as well of native plants that that are good for your pond. The root systems on all these native aquatic plants are designed to filter out excess nutrients. So that's where your water crow's foot, your iris, anything that has like aerial roots or they spread by rhizomes. So like your burrreeds, I love burrreeds. I don't know why, I'm just a big fan of them. I think they're cool. They have these little spiky fruit heads. You know, they all take excess nutrients out of the water and they don't tend to dominate. But if you're concerned, grow it in a basket, you know, very simple. Keep it in the basket. If it gets too big for the basket, take it out, chop the rhizomes up. It's like a rhubarb. Give them to your friend down the road because you know that you've got native stock source that are acclimatized to the Irish weather. And you know that yours, you don't have any nasty pathogens around because you're a good pond keeper. And now your neighbor has some lovely native plants. And you've got potentially a little side business there selling native oxygenators or native plants for wildlife because they're very, very difficult to get. And this is where a lot of people fall down. Like they come to us and say, look, we can't source them. Or, you know, everybody is told to do your pond work during the winter, but you can't, or it's very difficult to source native aquatic plants during the winter because nobody will sell them to you because there's no guarantee they'll grow come the following spring. So people won't take that punt by selling it to you. So you have to kind of wait till now to start buying in your stock. And then you're unsure because if it's come from the Netherlands, and then you unleash them into the Irish environment, they mightn't do very well. And then people get cranky. If you spend €13 on a nice yellow flag or whatever, and then it doesn't grow and it just fails straight away because it doesn't like. Like I had snow today in Wicklow. Like I got up this morning to 1.5 inches in the snow in April. And they're just not adapted. You get cranky and kind of a bit disillusioned very quickly. So just like I know we seem to be going on a bit about plants, but just be very, very careful that you don't put anything. If you're unsure, don't buy it. Ask somebody first. That's the best way to go. Or ask somebody that you hope would be responsible to give you a proper answer, you know, before you put it in your pond. There's only one species of native lily, and that's the white one, the Nymphaea alba. And that's beautiful. And that's all you need in terms of lilies, because they will take over as well. And again, grow it in the basket that you buy it in if you're going to buy it from somebody. And if you get it from somebody, if they've chopped up their lily like a rhubarb and they've given you a bit, buy a basket. It'll cost you €2 or something from a garden centre. Lash it in there. You can put it in gravel. You don't need to add soil or anything to it. You just need to weigh down the basket a little bit so the roots go towards the bottom of the pond. And then leave it there. The benefit of the basket then means if you do need to move it or you want to move it or you need to chop it out again or whatever, you can just hook it out or pull it out by hand. Sure. You know, you're not pulling up the entire root system from the base of your pond. So, you know, you can be very clever in how you manage things.
Give us, just before you go, one more time, give us some direction on pond creation links or resources. Anything else you think is useful?
Yeah, so the Freshwater Habitats Trust have all of their guidance on building ponds, no matter what type of habitat you find yourself. So, you know, a garden in the west of Ireland will be very different from a garden on anywhere in the east coast, because you tend to be peaty soil in the west and you tend to be on clay rich soil, particularly around Dublin and Wicklow. So whatever's going on in your garden in terms of soil type, soil structure, underlying bedrock, the Freshwater Habitats Trust have guidance there on their website, free to download as PDFs. If you want to build a pond because your stream at the bottom of your garden regularly overflows, they have guidance on how to do that too. Like, it's brilliant. This is all there. Like, and this is where I send local authorities and everybody to look for ideas. You know, Freshwater Habitats Trust is by far where we should be taking our lead from. Those guys do everything properly. Like, it's incredible. From major infrastructure projects right down to garden ponds, it's brilliant. They have a book out called The Pond Book, which is like the pond Bible. The Ontashka team are going to have a new version of that based like with an Irish focus coming out, I think, at the end of this year. That's part of their EU Life project, the Legacy for Life project. There's plenty of good resources online, like Joel Ashton. He's one of the Butterfly Brothers. That's what people like probably would know his name from, but he's gone out on his own now. He does a lot of really cool stuff on his YouTube page. And because he travels around the UK, and now he started to do stuff in his own place in France, and he's been in Panama and stuff, he's very good at explaining and showing how he builds and designs wildlife ponds. It's excellent. It's very good. So he's an incredible resource as well. And then obviously then, if you need something a bit closer to home, and for people who generally tend to spend a lot of time on social media or the hellscape that is Twitter, contact myself or Collie, you know, or the HSI, and we'll get back to you fairly sharpish. You know, and that's really it. Like it's the same with everything, you know, all the stuff you need is already in existence. Nobody needs to reinvent the wheel now when it comes to building ponds. The best thing to do is just get stuck in and start lashing them into gardens and schools and green spaces and everywhere else. That's the aim of the game. We've lost 90% of our wetlands, so like a couple of initiatives wouldn't go far, and getting the farmers involved, man. Some of the best ponds I've seen in the last 24 months, last 2 years, have been on farmland. And some incredible wetland habitats there. Everything from actual Annex 1 wet woodlands right away to like incredibly diverse, rich, integrated constructing wetlands where they're just offsetting the runoff from the yard, you know, to stop it going into the local stream. Really, really cool stuff. And just and this isn't me being a big head. Like, I was at the Tullamore show there last August. My partner, she's an ag science teacher, so we go to all the big shows. I ended up speaking to the lads from Skillsnet for about 2 hours and just talking to farmers who came along, who were all looking on advice on how to put ponds onto their farms, because they're not going to be penalised by CAP now, but they also want to do something. And obviously, some of these would need to be functional, so there'd need to be a sump if we're going to have more droughts like we had last year. You know, these guys are trying to future-proof the farm, which is incredible. So we need more, the new results-based payment schemes. We need one for ponds and farms. You know, that's where you're going to make the real big inroads. The local authorities as well, you know, but you have your work cut out for you as well, because you also have development. But, you know, there's easy wins there. You can just make sure developers, you know, are including nature-based solutions wherever possible, you know, wherever it's realistic. Within the budget and the development itself, you know, where it's appropriate. You know, and that's kind of it. So if all the big players can play the big roles, Joe Public can put in their garden wildlife ponds. I think, you know, that's a small effort plus the big national effort will turn things around very, very quickly.
Great stuff there, Ricky. Rob certainly knows his stuff, and he really is an evangelist for ponds. I'm going to put a pond in my own garden, having heard that. I've just got a small little garden, but I'll do my best. They really are great for so much wildlife, and not least those wonderful amphibians. They, you know, who wouldn't want to have those around?
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of detail there too. And he mentioned some links. And what we will do is we'll put those links to those resources and guidelines in our episode description in all the podcast places. So people will be able to hit those links there. So do look out for those. And yeah, if you're motivated like Niall, do get out the spade and the shovel and your pond liner and get a pond into the garden. And like I said, micro ponds even are really good habitats. So you can have a really small one, or if you've got more space, put in something massive. So that's good. So look, let's not leave this episode without linking it back to bird somehow, and we'll do our favourite bit in bird of the week. And we normally allow our guests to nominate them, but this week I told Rob he was to nominate sort of grey herons, and his colleague, and mentioned earlier on, Collie Ennis has really, he's an ambassador to get rid of herons around the place, because they've been sort of hassling his ponds for years and eating his newts and his frogs and the other invertebrates. So Collie's not a big fan, but he won't be happy with us promoting the grey herons. So tell us about those.
Well, they are great birds. I suppose live and let live. Yeah, they are one of the few creatures out there that do regularly and happily eat frogs. Mammals find it very difficult to eat frogs because they have this toxin in their skin that causes them to vomit. But many birds, like herons, don't have that problem, so they can just swallow them down. The grey heron, it's a very widespread bird in Ireland. It's one that if you have a large garden pond, you're very likely to get one to come in at some stage. You see them around all sorts of water bodies, but they will go to the coast as well. You will see them in saltwater and brackish areas as well. It's a very tall bird with a very, very long neck, very, very long legs, predominantly grey, but they have actually this lovely patterning, these sort of black flecks, like ermine tails on their white necks, this long dagger-like bill that they use to stab and catch frogs and fish. And I suppose when you watch them, it's a masterclass in patience, because their hunting strategy is to stay still in one spot and wait for their food to come to them. So they'll lay in wait, often near the shallows. They keep their neck almost like coiled, almost like a spring. They have that energy waiting to be released. And when something comes within striking distance, they dart forward and... And when something comes within striking distance, they dart forward and they grab it or spear it with that sharp, sharp beak. And they really are wonderful creatures. As we've discussed before in the podcast, in many parts of Ireland, people sometimes call them cranes. They talk about the crane they see down in the pond or in the park. And actually what they're referring to is the grey heron. We had once a bird commonly found in Ireland called the common crane, which has bred again after a long absence of 400 years. Somehow the folk name came transferred to the grey heron, which is a similar looking bird in many respects. But although the grey heron is a large bird, it's nowhere near as big as a true crane. Cranes are massive. But the grey heron is one of the biggest birds that you'll see generally around. They have an enormous wingspan too. So when you see them flying, it almost looks a bit like a bird of prey sometimes, this huge big wingspan like a buzzard. And sometimes you'll see sometimes other birds will react to them almost like they are birds of prey. They'll mob them and chase them. So sometimes crows or even blue tits will annoy them. Maybe they're tricked into thinking they're birds of prey. I'm not sure. But certainly a widespread species across Ireland. And I particularly like seeing them during the first part of the summer months when they're in their breeding finery, because in common with lots of heron and egret species around the world, they develop these really elaborate plumes on their chests that they keep in good condition. But also they have, you'll see on grey herons, they have these two long black feathers that sort of curl back behind their head, sort of very swept back. It makes them look very stately and very elegant. So herons need to keep their plumage in tip-top condition. So in that the family, the herons and the egrets and the bitterns, uniquely among birds, they have a special adaptation where they have a built-in comb on one of the toes, one of the claws of each foot. They're called pectinations. And they use that to actually groom their feathers and keep them in good condition, because having them in their finery is very important. I remember once watching a grey heron at Buddhist Town Marsh many years ago, back when I was a kid. And it caught, right in front of me, it caught an eel. It's the first time I'd ever seen an eel there. It was quite a big eel. It was amazing to watch how it tackled it. This eel started wrapping itself around the heron's neck and started exuding all this horrible slime. And most birds would drop the eel at that stage. They don't want the slime all over the feathers. There's something about heron feathers. It seems that somehow they can neutralize this defense from the eel. It just has to produce all the slime. It kind of rolls off the bird. And then it swallowed the eel into its long neck. Now, birds, of course, don't have teeth. And when you see herons catching their prey, they often don't see any need to actually kill it before they swallow it. So this unfortunate eel was thrashing around inside this heron's neck for several minutes before it finally succumbed. Quite a gruesome thing to watch, but something really amazing to see with your own eyes. And as a kid, it made a huge impression on me. I wasn't grossed out by it. I just thought herons are really cool birds.
They absolutely are. They are. And like cormorants, sometimes they can bite off more than they can chew. They'll get a giant fish and they'll almost choke on it. I'm pretty sure they do on occasions fully choke on flatfish and bits and bobs they shouldn't have eaten. But they are. I mean, they're designed for murdering. And like especially if you ever had the fortune or misfortune of seeing one's skull, a heron's skull, it's basically just a spear from the bill all the way back to the, it's like it's just spear-like, and its fur being protruded into the water and grabbing things and stabbing things. And then that long neck, like you say, is a spring. And I think coresc, the pronunciation is probably wrong, but it basically means long-necked person, doesn't it? Is I think the Irish.
Like a lanky kind of person, yeah.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. So they're amazing, and they're also we didn't mention is they're colonial nesters. So heronries exist, and they can be quite noisy and they're argumentative sort of birds when they're near each other, and they're always squawking. And it's certainly not a song, but just for continuity, we should play their sound or call.
Yep, very, very vocal around the nesting sites, which is interesting because often when you see them they by a pond or by a stream, they seem very serene. They don't seem to make much noise at all. Occasionally, if they're surprised, they make this croaking noise. But there's something really prehistoric about it. And actually, when you see them taking off and they make these noises, they're kind of reminiscent of pterodactyls. Not that I've ever seen a real pterodactyl with my own eyes, but what you see in the movies, it's kind of like that. There's something really prehistoric and reptilian almost about them.
No, absolutely. Yeah, you're right, though, like the paintings, like you, they'll be familiar to people from those Japanese-style lovely paintings by koi ponds and all that standing on one leg. And but yeah, in real life, they're sort of not as... they are majestic, but they've kind of got ill intent no matter where they go. And they're pale underneath, so a fish looking from the water below can't see them. Their legs are so thin, they don't even make a wake in the water when they're working their way through. They're just killing machines. They've evolved so well for that. And I suppose a famous heronry and a very accessible one is in St. Anne's Park, just in Clontarf there in Dublin.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a great spot for herons to be, because right beside that you have Bull Island, which is a wonderful place to watch herons doing the behaviours we've just described when they're catching prey. So I would definitely recommend people check that out. And alongside the grey herons there in St. Anne's Park, you also have little egrets nesting as part of that colony. And the noises of those two species together, it's absolutely bizarre, especially the youngsters. They make very strange noises. And it's kind of weird that such lanky, almost rangy looking birds that spend most of the time by water, they nest up high in the treetops, which is, it seems quite bizarre, but I guess they're pretty safe up there away from predators like foxes and so on. And for you know, for other predators that might normally go for birds' eggs and chicks, like squirrels, for example, I wouldn't like to be a squirrel that would take on a heron. I don't think it would end very well for the squirrel. I've also sometimes seen them at Dunleary Pier actually catching rats, which is interesting. So they will go for those too. You'll see them sometimes catching rats and mice. Sometimes they just bash them on a stone to kill them and just swallow them down. It's really quite amazing when you see it happen. And they can easily swallow a whole rat, no problem.
I bet they can. Okay, well, on that gruesome note, let's leave it there. I enjoyed that episode, and thanks again to Rob for joining us. And yeah, great.
Absolutely. So just to say, if you enjoyed this podcast, please do let your friends and family and colleagues know about it. The more listeners we can get, the better. Also, just a quick plug for Birdwatch Ireland membership. Birdwatch Ireland is a charity and we really need your support. So if you would join as members, we would really appreciate it. You can find full details at birdwatchireland.ie, where you'll also find lots of information about grey herons and other pond birds that you can see. And then just to conclude, as always, by saying that In Your Nature is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly, and the series is supported by Leash, Offaly and Westmeath County Councils, and the Heritage Council.